Trigger and content warning. There are uses of offensive wording in this episode. Please take caution. Hey guys, thank you for listening to Crime Cloud. To support the podcast, you can sign up for the Patreon for only $1 a month. Also, I want to say that there is a lot of confusion in the reporting of this case, and I tried my hardest to make sure that we had the most accurate information possible. And I also want to say that I fully support the LGBTQ plus community. This case that we're speaking about today was in 2010, and as a society back then, and unfortunately now, the community was not well respected or seen as people with rights. The victim's life and death that I'm covering today was poorly investigated, and their sexuality and identity was speculated and smeared after his death. Just know that I do not condone any of it, and I call on newspaper organizations and journalists to realize their role in this was very damaging to the victim's family, friends, and the LGBTQ plus community. So feel free to email me with suggestions or sources I should have looked into, as well as corrections on any information I put out and anything I might have said incorrectly. The major sources I used were from the BBC, The Guardian, Channel 4 News, The Sun, The Independent, and The Mirror. All of the articles I used will be in the show notes, and that link will be in the description of the episode. With that being said, let's get started with today's episode. 31-year-old Gareth Williams was originally from Holyhead, North Wales, which is a country part of the United Kingdom above England. There was a ton of speculation about what Gareth did for a living, but we eventually find out that he was an M16 worker who lived in central London in 2010. At 10 years old, Gareth went to secondary school and received A grades in a high level of maths and computer science at 13. For those outside of the UK, secondary school, according to Merriam-Webster, is, quote, a school intermediate between elementary school and college and usually offering general, technical, vocational, or college preparatory courses. Gareth began his university studies while at secondary school. He graduated with a first-class degree in maths from Bangor University at just 17 years old. So Gareth's family members, professors, friends, and people who knew Gareth described him as talented, logical, and an exceptional pupil. A quote from BBC News by Mr. Williams, a teacher at Bowdoin Secondary School, "If you explained something once to Gareth, he remembered it. You didn't have to explain it again." He was also described as extremely friendly, a great athlete, and loved music. His family said in a statement, "Gareth was a generous, loving son, brother, and friend." On the other side of the coin, Gareth's classmates described him as private, a loner, and seemed isolated by his intellect. Some saw him as naive, was too clever for school, and too young for university when he was younger. There is no doubt that Gareth was a smart guy, like I mentioned before. Gareth was very interested in codes and ciphers, and was said to be the best logician. He left home at 18 to begin a PhD at Manchester University. According to BBC News, in 2000, age 21, Gareth took a postgraduate certificate in mathematics at St. Catherine's College in Cambridge. In 2010, he was employed as a communications officer at the government communications headquarters, or GCHQ, in Cheddleham, Gloucestershire. I hope I said that right. I'm so sorry. He lived just half a mile away in a flat on the top floor in Pimlico, London. Newspaper articles said it was understood he was employed by the GCHQ, which provides intelligence, protects information, and informs relevant UK policy to keep society safe and successful in the internet age. It was also believed he was on secondment at the headquarters of M16, the Secret Intelligence Service, or also known as SIS, which means that he was tasked with combing and neutralizing external threats. Gareth didn't really tell much about his work life to his friends or family. As expected, his work was classified and his family kind of knew not to ask. So Gareth joined the Holyhead Cycling Club at 17. He was very athletic, like I mentioned earlier, and was a slender 5'7" to 8" man. And he was known for being really good on hill races and won the club's best all-rounder award a couple of times. Keith Thompson told the BBC News that Gareth wasn't the sort of person to go to pubs after a race, so he didn't have so many close friends in the club. No one knew about his private life except for cycling. He rarely went out after work, but had occasionally gone out for a drink with his coworkers. According to The Guardian, in June 2010, Gareth, his sister Kiri, a physiotherapist, and her husband, Dr. Chris Subb, a consultant at Wrexham Mallard Hospital, had gone out for tea at the Ritz in London to celebrate their second wedding anniversary. Kiri later told police that Gareth had been in the capital for more than 6 months, but couldn't say what he was doing there. They had spent the day laughing and joking around, and everything seemed all right with Gareth. Kiri and Gareth kept in contact via phone, and Kiri remembers she spoke to Gareth on August 11th after he returned from a short trip to the US. He needed to tidy things up before returning to GCHQ in September. Jenny Elliott, Gareth's landlady, had rented him a room in her Georgian townhouse in Alderney Street, Pimlico, near Cheltenham for the last 10 years he worked for GCHQ before transferring to London for a year. He called to rent the room again in August. Many bankers and politicians also lived in this neighborhood. Jenny told The Guardian that he was the best tenant one could ever have. He didn't have a TV, record player, or anything, and she never heard a word from him. He also never really brought anyone back to his home, and he had kept the simple furnishings that Jenny had lent him and never brought anything new in. Gareth was said to work late and left early. What was strange about Gareth as a tenant was that his neighbors never really heard anything from him or his flat. A quote from Channel 4, "His windows were always shut and curtains were often closed. I could never tell if anyone was in. It was strange that we never saw him come and go. I just assumed he worked away." The only people that had access to his flat was the landlady and his family who had keys. Gareth was in constant contact with his sister, Kiri, like I mentioned earlier. A week after her last call with Gareth, she decided to call him again, but he didn't answer. It wasn't like him to not answer or at least call back, and it wasn't long before Kiri became worried. After calling him several times with no answer, she decided to contact the police. Authorities had already been worried about Gareth's silence as he didn't show to work, and we know in his line of work of secret services that this is very concerning. Colleagues had noticed he hadn't shown up for 10 days and contacted police to conduct a welfare check. On August 23rd at 6:30 p.m., police were sent to Gareth's flat. A lettings agent, which for those who don't know is basically just a leasing agent at an apartment complex, they had let PC John Gallagher in Gareth's flat. According to The Guardian, Gallagher told the letting agent to wait downstairs. When he walked in the flat, he noticed that the apartment was spotless except for an Apple phone and several SIM cards on the table. According to BBC News, he also noticed a woman's wig hanging onto the corner of the chair. When Gallagher made his way to the bathroom, he saw that there was a bathrobe on the floor outside the closed door. He entered the bathroom and immediately noticed a red holdall in the bathtub. I didn't know what a holdall is either, but it's basically a large rectangular bag with handles and a shoulder strap, like a fancy-looking duffel bag. The bag raised alarm to Gallagher when he picked up the handle, smelled the smell of a body, and saw red liquid leak out of the bag. Gallagher realized that this very well could be a crime scene and radioed for backup. While waiting, he noticed that there weren't any signs of struggle in the bathroom or the rest of the flat. Detective Sergeant Paul Colgan arrived and cut open the holdall. A quote from The Guardian, "Inside was a body in such a contorted position he thought its legs and arms had been cut off. The body was naked with the keys from the padlock bag under the body." Nothing seemed to be out of place in the flat besides the holdall or indicated that there was a robbery or home invasion. The front door was even locked from the outside. This was a, quote, neat job, according to The Guardian. Since Gareth was in secret intelligence and a body was found in his apartment, M15 agents, detectives from the Homicide and Service Crime Command, and the SO15, the Scotland Yard's Counterterrorism Command, came in to investigate the crime scene. The man found in the bag was pronounced dead at the scene, and police could only say that the man was white and aged in his 30s because of how decomposed the body was. But they did have an idea that the body belonged to Gareth, but could not say for sure. The Metropolitan Police backed up Gallagher's findings of the flat when they began investigating and found that there was no weapon, no sign of forced entry or struggle, and that this was indeed a neat job. They also found that the body did not have any signs or stab or bullet wounds, and he was intact, meaning he was not hacked to pieces. Between August 24th and 25th, detectives informed Gareth's family from Wales that a man thought to be Gareth was found dead in his flat. Early news stories had spread that Gareth could be a British spy, he was stabbed to death, and that he worked with codes. Like I mentioned before, his family was not really aware of what he did for a living, and they only knew he worked with codes. They wondered if he was really a spy, and was he murdered? What was his job title exactly? Newspapers had also spread misinformation about the stab wounds, by the way. According to The Guardian, news came out that the building the body that was believed to belong to Gareth was found in was owned by a private company registered offshore called New Rodina. Rodina was Russian for motherland, and news stories theorized that maybe Gareth could have been guilty of espionage, to explain it lightly. Gareth's parents, Ian and Ellen Williams, arrived in London, and because of the level of decomposition, they could only provide family photos to ID the body. The body did belong to Gareth. A lot of the information I have found from the investigation that various newspapers had reported came from the coroner's inquest in March 2012. A coroner's inquest is an inquiry or investigation into the cause of an unexplained, sudden, or violent death. Before we go on, I want to say that a lot of evidence was mismanaged by police and that the SO15 didn't do their due diligence in the investigation from theories and mismanaging evidence. Scotland Yard also couldn't dig too far into what Gareth did for work because they were being blocked from the security services from doing so. They interviewed Gareth's landlady, Jenny Elliott, his sister Carrie and her husband, and neighbors to find out more details about him, which I had already mentioned. Everything we know was kind of hearsay until officials came out to discuss what he did for work further, which I will discuss, but I want to provide more facts about the case before I go into what he actually did for work. On August 25th, Home Office pathologist Dr. Benjamin Swift carried out an autopsy on the body. He began by conducting toxicological tests, but they came back inconclusive. There weren't any signs of drugs, alcohol, or poison in Gareth's system. Without any direct possibility of cause of death, they couldn't find anything to indicate the cause. They believe the man had been in the holdall for at least 2 weeks and died in the early hours of August 16th, but found that the heating was on in the flat, which increased the rate of decomposition. That also meant that retrieving evidence from the body was way more difficult than normal. In the coroner's inquest in 2012, Coroner Fiona Wilcox said it was very unlikely that he got into the bag by himself, that his death was unnatural and likely to have been criminally meditated. At first, police believed there was no way Gareth could put himself in the bag. He was a good 5 feet and 7 inches tall, and the zips and lock of the bag meant that it would be difficult to just put oneself in. The lock on the bag was locked from the outside. The bathroom door was closed at discovery and the light was turned off. The phone found on the table in the flat was also wiped of memory and returned to factory settings. We are not sure if M16, Gareth, or a third party involved in his death had wiped the phone. There wasn't any DNA evidence, fingerprints, or any sign of entry in the flat. DNA found on Gareth's hand was tested, but it ended up matching a scientist who was working at the crime lab. Investigators did find a crumpled green hand towel that originally was in the bathroom, but during the initial investigation was moved into the kitchen. They also found a hair, tested it, and found it belonged to a person other than Gareth, but didn't have any technology to do anything beyond that. I couldn't find who sent in this next tip or where it originally came from, but in early September 2010, the police had sent details and EFIT images, which are computer-generated pictures of someone who is suspected of a crime, to the public of a couple that were said to have entered Gareth's flat in early June or July. Police said that the couple was thought to be Mediterranean and in their early 20s. Police were hoping someone would come forward and identify them, but that sort of ended as a bust. In September 2010, investigators did find CCTV footage of Gareth walking by the Holland Park tube station in West London on August 14th around 3 p.m., 3 days after he had spoken to his sister, and a couple of days before his sister called again to no answer. A cafe had also claimed that a man resembling Gareth had spent several hours sitting with a laptop and had several visitors while he worked. Police found more CCTV footage of Gareth at a cash machine on August 15th around 2 p.m. He then went into a Harrods store, which is basically a clothing store in the UK, and was seen walking at 2:30 p.m. towards Sloane Street. They didn't find any more footage of him after that. At the end of September, forensic scientists conducted another set of toxicology tests, but they were inconclusive as well. His body was finally released and laid to rest in North Wales on September 26, 2010. There were rumors that this was a matter of terrorism or national security links. One was that Gareth completed suicide to have a release from his stressful life, and one was that he was murdered in a hit. Another rumor was maybe a sadistic or masochistic sexual act gone wrong. This last theory was extremely big in news stories and was a primary focus for detectives for a while. Before I go on, I feel like I need to say again that a victim's sexuality and identity should not be a talking point in cases when it is very obvious that it had nothing to do with what happened to them. We see it time and time again that sexuality and identity are what people end up talking about when it comes to victims, and the victims are shamed for it. Detectives believed Gareth was gay and that his murder was related to this belief. What I am confused about, despite why his sexuality and identity mattered, was the misinformation about this case spread. They had apparently found a semen stain on the bathroom floor that matched Gareth, and Hamish Campbell, the detective chief superintendent who oversaw the investigation, said that the other theories that they had gone with regarding a Russian hit was kind of squashed when they found the stain. Quote from the Mirror from Campbell, I felt it was improbable his body fluid could be present in a violent, non-consenting scenario. Considering Gareth's tidiness and cleanliness, we surmise the semen was from the day of his entry into the bag. But was he alone or not? It would be difficult to imagine him having intimacy with a Russian hitman or female spy. Before we discuss the direction they wanted to keep taking, can we just say that someone could be in a very violent and or non-consenting sexual assault and still orgasm? There are many stories that victims have come out and said that this had happened to them, and the body does what it does when stimulated, with consent or not. And despite what Campbell said, I also didn't find anywhere that conclusively said that the stain was recent, otherwise him just being organized with his cleaning. The Guardian came out in 2010 and said newspapers ran stories discussing Gareth's, quote, private life. The detectives thought Gareth was, quote, a secret transvestite who may have been killed by a gay lover. The Guardian didn't say, but I found those news reports from The Sun and BBC News. Police found 15,000 euros, or around $16,000 worth of women's clothing that were kept in six boxes that could fit him at his flat. I had already mentioned earlier that the policeman that discovered Gareth's body reported finding wigs over a chair, which he had said in a coroner's inquest later in 2012. Other newspapers, including The Sun and BBC News, supposedly quoted unnamed sources that reported finding cocaine, gay pornography, S&M paraphernalia, and evidence that Gareth regularly met with male escorts. According to Jenny, his landlady, she found Gareth tied to his bed in his boxer shorts in what she thought was a sexually motivated act. She said he was calling for help when he couldn't untie himself. Police looked for witnesses in the Vauxhall Cross Village that consisted of gay bars and clubs, which was a short walk from Gareth's flat. Apparently, according to The Independent, Gareth had visited a drag show at a club 10 days before his death and a gay bar 3 months earlier. According to the 2010 article from The Guardian, detectives combed through Gareth's computers, journals, magazines, computer cache, and transactions to find any evidence if Gareth was gay and was seeing someone or was interested in S&M, but were unable to find anything that suggested anything. There was no evidence of Gareth paying for male escorts, buying S&M equipment, using porn or drugs, or even drinking. Then, in another article released in 2012 by The Guardian, confirmed that police had in fact found evidence of the, quote, private life story that they were shaming other newspapers of spreading. A quote from that article, and trigger warning, it contains some offensive wording such as transvestite. The word transvestite is not used now by the LGBTQ+ community and definitely not my wording, but news sources did use it. Quote, he, meaning Gareth, had visited a transvestite act 2 days before he failed to turn up for work and accessed drag queen websites. He had taken two fashion design courses at Central St. Martin's College without telling M16. But the coroner's inquest, which was in 2012, was told the visits to the Bondage websites were sporadic and isolated, making up a tiny percentage of his time online. Anthony O'Toole, the family's lawyer, suggested the bedpost incident coincided with his first failed attempt to join M16, and the website access coincided with his future successful application and then preparation for training courses. Detective Chief Inspector Jackie Sabir asked if it was possible he was, quote, preparing for courses and, quote, escaping from being tied, and has asked for information on the courses, but, quote, no information has come back. She confirmed that he has not visited sadomasochism or claustrophobia sites. At 60 kilograms and 1.72 meters, Williams could possibly have fitted into the clothes, and she thought the shoes too. Friends did not believe he bought them for himself, but as gifts. The shoes would have also fitted his sister. There were unverifiable reports of him visiting gay bars. Police found no sexual partner. Dr. Wilcox had also stated that there was no evidence from the autopsy that Gareth was transgender. In the 2012 inquest, Dr. Wilcox had criticized the handling of Gareth's phone that was found at his work locker that contained deleted pictures of Gareth naked in boots. The officer had kept the phone in his possession until a couple of days before the inquest before handing it over. In an article by Channel 4 News in August 2010, they stated that earlier reporting that Gareth was secretly gay or owned bondage equipment was untrue, and there were no numbers for male escorts on the phone SIM cards that were found in his flat. So when I was writing this story, it was really hard to find the truth in all of this. Did the police find the evidence I mentioned or not? News reports kept saying they did not, and then they actually did. I personally believe they did based on the 2012 coroner's inquest, but I don't feel that any of it was tied into his death, and his friends and family don't think so either. Gareth's family and coworkers denied the allegations that he was a, quote, transvestite and or gay. Again, that is not the wording anybody should use today. His family was very distressed that this was the investigator's focus at all and thought his sex life or identity could not link to his death. They figured that his name was being smeared on purpose but wondered why anyone would do so. According to the BBC, a friend of Gareth said that police should have broadened the search beyond his private life and that police did wrong by releasing the information about women's clothing when they didn't reveal there was 10,000 euros or about $11,000 worth of mountaineering equipment as well. His clothes were too small and could have been for her or her sister. Carrie, his sister, wasn't surprised at all by the clothes and said the clothing could have been for gifts, like I said earlier. In the coroner's inquest in 2012, Dr. Wilcox also criticized that the leaks to the media about Gareth, quote, cross-dressing was irrelevant and that she believed it was a possible attempt by, quote, some third party to manipulate a section of the evidence. When shown the picture of Gareth naked in boots, she said she couldn't dispute that, but there were plenty of other people who liked doing the same thing. What police should have done from the very start was look into his work and the possibilities that he could have crossed someone in his line of work that wanted to take him out due to his knowledge of terrorist relations or whatnot. I don't want to assume anything about Gareth, and from what I read, I do think there is a possibility that he was gay and had maybe worn women's clothing. And I don't think that was a bad thing, and I don't think his sexuality or gender identity had anything really to do with his death. This theory should not have been the only theory looked into this extensively. The other theory was that his career might have been involved in his death. His family had told the media that they were sure that Gareth's death was done by a, quote, member of some agency specializing in the dark art of the Secret Services. It was clear that throughout the investigation, M16 did not want to look in Gareth's line of work or what he did because it was all supposed to be top secret. They also didn't want to look into the possibility that Gareth's co-workers and bosses might have had something to do with his death. To say it as easily as I can, and from what I can understand, Gareth did work with the GCHQ in 2003 to assemble, search, and analyze data connected to Islamist violence in the UK and abroad. He worked with the US intelligence to help intercept emails and phone calls between the people behind the liquid bomb plot, which according to The Guardian was, quote, a group of British radicals of Asian origin that were found to be planning to detonate homemade explosives that boarded 7 flights to major North American cities. According to The Guardian, Gareth was on secondment to M16, which focused on foreign targets and intelligence gathering, like I mentioned before, and this kind of made him a spy. He had also worked back at GCHQ to work with counterparts of the NSA. Apparently, he had recently been researching British vulnerability to Russian, Turkish, and Chinese gangs. All of this came out from past retired co-workers and officials working in the organizations mentioned earlier, and according to The Guardian, Gareth had many ties to people that he, quote, had observed, investigated, disrupted, and provoked. According to the Daily Telegraph, Carrie Gareth's sister said in the coroner's inquest in 2012 that his enthusiasm about his job was fading and he was becoming more uncomfortable about the amount of red tape he encountered. He also mentioned that there was friction in the office. Gareth had started at SIS in London in spring 2009 but wanted to return to the GCHQ because he, quote, disliked the rat race, flash car competitions, and post-work drinking culture. He had apparently wanted to go back to the countryside. According to The Guardian, Dr. Wilcox's verdict was highly critical of the Metropolitan Police's counterterrorism branch in M16. She mentioned that Garrett's co-workers failed to report him missing for 7 days after he didn't report to work. Wilcox said Garrett's line manager's explanation for not reporting him missing sooner lacked credibility and that she could, quote, only speculate as to what effect this had on the investigation. SO15 also failed to inform the senior investigating officer, Jackie Sabri, about 9 memory sticks in a black holdall found in Garrett's M16 office until 2 days before the scheduled inquest, as well as the phone containing the naked pictures of Garrett. At the inquest, pathologist Benjamin Swift said that in his post-mortem examination, there was heat that radiated in the flat because radiators were turned on in the middle of the summer. I had mentioned this previously. I believe that Dr. Wilcox and Dr. Swift was in agreement with this, but Dr. Swift said that he probably suffocated or was killed by a poison which disappeared in his system during decomposition. Ian Calder, who performed the second post-mortem examination, said the buildup of carbon dioxide would have become poisonous to Garrett within 2 or 3 minutes. Dr. Wilcox said there wasn't any present evidence to suggest that his work or personal life had anything to do with Garrett's death, but according to the Telegraph said, quote, the possibility that another member of the Secret Intelligence Service was involved was and remains a legitimate line of inquiry. Dr. Wilcox also criticized the fact that the DNA that was supposedly found on Garrett's hand came from a scientist from the forensics lab. And remember the Mediterranean couple that the police had believed could be involved in Garrett's murder? It turns out that they had no relevance to the case at all. Evidence at the inquest showed that it was absolutely impossible for Garrett to have locked himself in the bag. Two experts were unable to lock themselves in a similar bag despite 400 attempts and said there was a very, very small chance Garrett could have put himself in the bag. Like I mentioned before, Dr. Wilcox had said that Garrett was probably killed unlawfully and that his death was unnatural and likely to have been criminally meditated. Garrett probably entered in the bag himself and could have died within 3 minutes either from being overcome by carbon dioxide or some unknown poison. However, she did believe that a third party placed the bag into the bath and locked the bag. Dr. Wilcox said she didn't think suicide, interest in bondage, or, quote, cross-dressing or autoerotic activity was involved in Garrett's death, like I had mentioned before. She also said that it was very likely we might never know how Garrett died. After the coroner's inquest, the Metropolitan Police reinvestigated Garrett's case. This lasted 12 months, and police were allowed to look more into what Garrett did for work. According to the Huffington Post, in 2013, Metropolitan Police Deputy Assistant Commissioner Martin Hewitt said that Garrett's death was probably an accident after re-examining evidence. A police review found little evidence that there was foul play in the death and also disagreed with the conclusion found in the 2012 inquest that Garrett was killed by another person. That didn't necessarily mean that he wasn't killed, from my understanding, just that there were literally no evidence to point in a different way. They decided that he could have gone into the bag himself and died from asphyxiation. There is no evidence to suggest a cover-up, nothing to suggest that the apartment had been cleaned to remove forensic traces, and nothing to suggest a struggle or break-in, even though there wasn't any DNA or fingerprints literally anywhere in the apartment. Despite the review, Garrett's family still believed, and rightfully so in my opinion, that it was very likely that Garrett was the victim of foul play, and they stand with Dr. Wilcox's statement. News organizations reported that before 2015, Scotland Yard dismissed the case as a sex game that went wrong, that Garrett probably accidentally locked himself inside the bag, that no one was in the flat at the time, and then closed the case, which led to his death. It looks like everyone believed this, especially with how crappy the investigation went. A couple years went by before we heard anything about Garrett's case, and I feel like this is a good theory, but a big if. If that makes sense. In 2015, according to The Independent, a former major in the KGB named Boris Karpikov claimed intelligence sources in Russia have admitted that Garrett was, quote, exterminated by Russian intelligence agents because he refused to become a double agent and supposedly knew the identity of a Kremlin spy working inside GCHQ. Apparently, the SVR had threatened to reveal that Garrett enjoyed, quote, cross-dressing, before Garrett revealed in turn to know the person who had tipped him off to the Russians. The mole's code name was Oren. According to the Mirror, Gareth and the mole Orin were good friends, but the Russians wanted to not risk exposure. His spymaster, an undercover agent posing as a rich East European businessman codenamed Lucas, tried to blackmail Gareth. When that failed, Lucas showed up at Gareth's flat with a bottle of wine. Gareth accepted a glass but passed out. The glass was spiked with a mixture of amyl nitrate and the Viagra drug Slidifol. A squad known as the Cleaners arrived to finish the assassination using an untraceable poison, which was pushed into his ear using a needleless syringe. Boris also said that an SVR cleanup team returned to Gareth's flat through a skylight to clean the flat and remove any evidence of what happened. He said he thought the bag was left behind because something must have gone wrong. The SVR or FSB killers always disposed of bodies to make the murders harder to investigate. Boris lived in the Pimlico area near Gareth and saw Russian diplomatic cards in the area around the time of Gareth's death and thought that they were there for Boris. Boris was put under a death sentence by Russian spymasters when he escaped to Britain 20 years ago, apparently. 10 days before Gareth was discovered, and around the time investigators believe Gareth to have died, Boris noticed that the cars were gone and he never saw them again. In 2020, former MP Norman Baker claimed Gareth was murdered for his work investigating the laundering of Russian money. He was going off the claims of Boris and said that Boris told him that Russian contacts informed Boris of all of this. Baker said that the M16 tried to cover up the hit because it might alarm the public, and they erased the 9 memory sticks that were found because it had data to suggest that Gareth was tied into looking into the Russians. I'm not sure what is credible from Boris or Baker, and I couldn't find much more about anything after this stuff came out. Reporting of Gareth being assassinated by the SVR kind of stopped after 2020. In 2021, Hamish Campbell, who is now a retired detective chief superintendent, like I mentioned earlier, who oversaw the investigation, thought that after 11 years, it was time to have a new review of the case. He wanted DNA fragments belonging to two people found on the padlock in the holdall's handle, as well as the hair that was found to belong to someone other than Gareth, to be retested, as well as an unknown person's DNA found on a green towel, which was originally in the bathroom, but moved to the kitchen by investigators for some reason. Campbell also thought that Gareth got in the bag of his own free will, but also acknowledged it would be bizarre to crawl in the bag voluntarily, and that there would have been marks or other signs of a struggle if he was stripped and forced in the bag. I'm not too sure about this because if someone was pointing a gun at him, he could have been more complacent with climbing in the bag. Campbell still believes that Gareth's death was due to his personal life and not connected to their work. The Sunday Times reported that it was possible that advances in DNA would allow further study of the hair and could lead to the possible killer. In February 2021, Angela Gallup, a forensic scientist who founded the lab that carried out testing on the hair, said that a profile could be extracted from 2 millimeters of hair and she would be happy to help the police if they asked. I'm skeptical of the hair, honestly, because the forensic lab testing DNA found at the crime ended up being a lab tech's DNA. What if the hair belonged to one of the many investigators that walked in Gareth's flat? The Metropolitan Police later in 2021 said that they would consider reopening the case and reviewing everything if there was really a way to identify a person through the hair and if they were able to retest the DNA found. A spokesperson had confirmed that they were re-examining the case and that detectives were waiting for results. A quote from the BBC, "There is an established review process for investigations whereby new information and/or forensic opportunities are considered. The Met is currently undertaking a forensic review to assess whether there are any new investigative opportunities in this case and we await its outcome. We remain in close contact with Gareth's family to ensure they are fully supported." I personally haven't found any recent news about the case after 2021, and I suspect that the police are still investigating its review, but I will update the episode when we get any more updates. So how do you feel about this case? Do you believe that Gareth put himself in the bag or someone else did it? And if someone else did it, do you think it was a partner or a Russian hit? I think there is more to the story that the Secret Intelligence Service and GCHQ aren't telling us, and I also think that it is possible that Gareth was undercover maybe, but I also think that it could be possible that Gareth just liked dressing in women's clothes. I don't know what to believe in this case due to the bad police work, the misinformation spread amongst the media, and what his friends and family described Gareth as. If he did like dressing in women's clothes, I feel that it was his business and that the world didn't need to know unless he wanted them to know, if that makes sense. If that did have something to do with the Russian hit, then so be it, but I still don't condone the way the police and the media handled the case and the information they had. The way investigators looked extensively in only that direction really bothered me, especially because I feel there is more evidence that wasn't released. I hope his friends and family are finding support, and I hope that his case gets solved. They deserve more, and Gareth certainly does as well. Send me your suggestions of what you think happened, or any corrections with sources I should have looked at. This case was a doozy, and there was so much that I couldn't even look at. And I also want to say again that I am an ally to the LGBTQ plus community, and if I have offended anyone with my wording or said something incorrectly or explained something poorly, please email me and let me know. I want to be there for you, and I want to be a good source of information for everyone, and I want to be inclusive for everyone. Thank you so much for listening this week, and please stay safe out there. Thank you for listening to Crime Cloud. If you would like to access my Instagram, go to @CrimeCloudPodcast. And for my Twitter, go to @CrimeCloudPod. To find the blog, go to CrimeCloudPodcast.blog. To email suggestions or corrections, use CrimeCloudPodcast@gmail.com. Thank you again for listening and supporting the podcast.